You may have heard a great deal about southern charm and grace, and there's something in it where Virginia and Kentucky are concerned, but it don't hold for the Mississippi Valley. They were rotten with cotton money in those days, with gold watch chains and walking sticks, loud raucous laughter, and manners that would have disgraced a sty. They spat their tobacco juice on the carpets, gorged noisily in the dining saloon. The sight of jellied quail being shoveled down with a spoon and two fingers is a sight that dwells with me still. They hawked and belched and picked their teeth and swilled great quantities of brandy and punch and roared to each other in their hideous plantation voices. Mississippi food, once you get outside Orleans, tends to be robust and rich. And that first evening I wolfed my stewed chicken, prime steak and creamed chocolate with all the more relish for the thought of Randolph, squatting on the main deck, regaling himself on pulse and pone. I had champagne, too, and brandy, and finally topped the whole thing off with a buxom little cracker girl in my cabin. Her name was Penny, or Jenny, I forget which. She had dyed gold hair which went vilely with her yellow satin dress, and she was one of your squealing hoydens, but she had tremendous energy and high-pointed breasts of which she was immensely proud, which made up for a lot. Most of the women on the boat were noisy. The respectable ones clacked and squawked to each other interminably, and the mistresses and whores, of whom there seemed to be a great number, were brassy enough to be heard in San Francisco. Penny, or Jenny, was one of the quieter ones. She didn't scream with laughter above once a minute. I was lying there, drowsy and well satisfied, listening to her prattling, when a nigger waiter comes up with a message that I was wanted on the main deck. Wondering what the devil was what, I went down and to my rage and concern discovered that it was that confounded George. The overseer was swearing and stamping, with Randolph standing in front of him looking as arrogant as Caesar. "What's the matter with it, damn ye?" the overseer was shouting. And then seeing me, "Say, look here, Mr. Prescott, here's that Jim Dandy nigger of yours don't like this year commodation. No, sir, 'pears like 'tain't good enough for him." "What's this, George?" says I, pushing forward. "What are you about, my boy, turning up your nose at the quarters? What's wrong with them, sir?" He looked me straight in the eye with as much side as old Lord Cardigan. "We have been given no store to make beds for ourselves. We are entitled to this. It is covered in the money you have paid for our passage." "Well, will you hear that now?" cries the overseer. Ain't it, aunt? What the hell you say? Don't you give me none of your shines, ye black rascal. Beds, by thunder, you'll lay right down where you're told, or by cracky, you'll be knocked down. Who are you that you gotta have straw to keep your tender carcass off'n the floor? T'other hands is laying on it, ain't it? Now you get right down there, do you hear?"
"My master has paid for us to have straw," says Randolph, looking at me. "The other slaves over yonder have it, only our coffle goes without."
"Well, there ain't no more goddamn straw, you no-good, impudent son of a bitch," cries the overseer, "so now I never heard the like."
I could have felled that bloody-ass Randolph on the spot. Couldn't the fool understand that he must behave as a slave? All I could do was play the just master, kindly but firm. "Come, come, George," I said sternly. "Let us have no more of this. Lie down where you are told directly." "What? Is this how you repay my kind usage, by impertinence? Have you forgotten yourself altogether, that you speak back to a white man? Lie down at once, sir, this instant."